I'm pleased to be back again. Enjoyed being here 2 weeks ago. Our focus 2 weeks ago was on forgiveness practice. And I wanted to include forgiveness practice in what we look at today, partly with the motivation of hearing from those who were energized and inspired to work with forgiveness practice in the 2 weeks since I was here last, and to hear what some of your experiences are, perhaps questions, observations, and so forth. But I wanted also to broaden the theme, so it was not focused on forgiveness, but forgiveness would be a part. And so I thought to continue with the general theme of working with heart practices, but have a focus of how we work with what we might call heart practices when there are difficulties. And the difficulties can be difficult situations, being with people whom we find difficult, and the difficult person, so-called, might be oneself. So, making the topic broad. So sometimes people say, you know, there just aren't difficult people in my life. Some people say that. You can, I don't know, I won't ask for a show of hands. But and then we want to give opportunities. So if there aren't any, as it were, external difficult people in your life, you can see whether you are sometimes a difficult person for yourself. And then if there aren't, if nothing's happening there, you can always bring in public figures. And if you don't have any difficult public figures, then you should probably be teaching. Okay. So I want to generally focus on the heart practices, but also bring in, to some extent, wisdom practices. And because that way that our heart practices integrate wisdom and mindfulness is quite important. So I want to cover a few different themes related to how we are with difficult situations or difficult people. And in fact, I want to invite you right now to reflect on a situation which might be there currently for you or has been there, this is just for yourself, which is or has been difficult relationship, maybe an ongoing difficult, chronically difficult relationship. Again, it could be some way that you are chronically hard on yourself, maybe a chronic self-judgment. And just reflect on that for a minute or two. How do you experience that difficult relationship, you know, perhaps to oneself? What thoughts, emotions come up? What's it feel like? What's it like? So just to see what's there for a moment. Thank you. So I want to focus on three areas that are important for our practice with difficult interactions, difficult situations. The first has to do with our attitude. The second has to do with our use of mindfulness and wisdom. And the third has to do with heart practices. And there I'll bring in, as part of that discussion, looking again at forgiveness practice. Now, it should be said that there are a lot of other practices and tools which could be very valuable for working with difficult people. And In fact, it's been a favorite topic of mine. It came out of my teaching on Wednesday morning at Spirit Rock, and quite a few years ago, I took a poll of what topics people wanted to have some exploration of, and one of the top most popular subjects was how to be with quote-unquote difficult people. And so we explored that quite a bit. And eventually I did a few day-longs where we took the whole day on that topic. So I want to acknowledge that it actually is quite a large topic. We could bring in a lot of other material. I'm going to focus mostly on those three aspects of what we might call doing inner practices with difficult people. But we also, if we were going to be comprehensive, we'd want to also do more outer practices. Ideally, if we were doing a sustained curriculum on difficult people, we would also have a lot on speech practice, a lot about how to be skillful using speech and communication with difficult people. We'd probably give attention to understanding how we work with conflict in general better. We'd have some work. We'd probably do a lot of role-playing, you know, which those of you who don't like role-playing want to let you know we're not doing any today. So you can attend fully to the talk and not worry about a role-play coming up. So, yeah. And so we would work with those outer practices. We might also do body practice. I found that working with body practices, like the Qigong we did, is actually very, very important for working skillfully with difficult interactions. And I found in my own experience, for example, that I could have a lot of wisdom, I could have my heart quite open, and if I wasn't grounded in my body, I would be knocked around. It's quite interesting. And so I had to learn further grounding in the body. You know, it's almost like the way we did that movement practice, the Qigong practice with the three centers, the heart, what I was calling the head, and then the belly. If you have just your heart and your, let's say, your mindfulness and your wisdom developed, and you don't have a center, maybe in the belly and the body, one can be knocked around a lot. It can be wonderfully open, and yet difficulties are way more challenging because there's not the grounding in the body. So I could focus there, but I'm going to focus on the inner practices of the attitude, wisdom, and heart practice. But just to acknowledge, I think that's quite important. You know, we found, I was the director, as some of you know, of a two-year program at Spirit Rock called The Path of Engagement, which was for people doing service work and social action in the world. And we found we wanted to have a body practice. Actually, Tija Bell came and led movement practices at all our retreats. And we found it very, very crucial. We did a lot of simulation of how to bring body practices into difficult situations. So I want to acknowledge that. And maybe another time we can focus there, but I'm not going to go there tonight. And similarly, there'd be a lot of other qualities which would be really wonderful to explore, that would be helpful to develop for being with difficulties, such as patience, such as courage, working with fear, working with anxiety, and so forth. So it's really to recognize that it's a large topic and that we're going to focus on a few areas, but it's not comprehensive. Although it should be helpful. I don't want to. It was almost like an advertisement against my whole talk, right? Don't want to go there. Okay, so first on attitude. The attitude with which we approach difficulties is really important. I think we know that. That if we take difficult circumstances as a curse and good circumstances as a blessing, we will not be so skillful when the difficulties come. And we should know that that's a natural tendency. It's part of our conditioning And some of us, it's more so the conditioning. I think, for example, I think I was raised to be conflict aversive. Does anyone relate to that? Okay. I don't think everyone raised their hands for whom that's true. Okay. Because I think it's a large percentage of the population. And so I know that I found when I started looking at my own conditioning, there was something about, oh, there's a difficulty. Oh, there's a conflict. Oh, I have a difficulty with someone else. There must be a problem here, right? Something's wrong. And it shouldn't be this way. And sometimes it goes even to self-judgment. Have you noticed that in your own mind? That, oh, something hasn't gone like I want. I must be at fault. And we go often to blaming ourselves or blaming others when things aren't as we wish. There even are difficult circumstances. Something must be wrong with me. I'm having unpleasant experiences. It's almost as if the conditioning is, and it's in the advertising, I guess, very much, we should only have good, pleasant experiences, right? And when we have unpleasant experiences, we are off the advertising script, right? Something must be wrong. So just to know that there's deep conditioning, because the suggestion here is to take difficulties as learning experiences, as potential learning experiences, which is a shift, right? For most of us, it's a shift. Oh, a difficulty, something to learn. Doesn't that seem foreign, like a foreign attitude? Oh, a difficulty, something to explore, something to learn. Oh, wonderful. How many have that attitude? Well, I won't ask for, but I think I know in my own conditioning, I can still feel something happens that's uncomfortable and something in me doesn't want it to be there. And it's harder to take an attitude of, oh, something to learn. You know, I remember I had a very important experience. It was over 20 years ago. I was part of a group. In a past life, I taught at universities and colleges for 7 years. And I was in philosophy departments, and I was interested in wisdom. Okay, I won't say so much there. But I was selected to be part of a program that actually brought me out to California, that was connected with Esalen, and that had a big grant. Michael Murphy from Esalen was part of it, and there were some wonderful people. It was a program called Revisioning Philosophy. And we wanted to bring the wisdom dimension back to philosophy, change a lot of things, make it really much more experiential, connect it with the body, the public sphere, real issues. Because those of you who may remember, if you took philosophy 101 in the universities, philosophy became something technical, and the large issues were not actually studied seriously. So we were part of a group. There were wonderful people. Jacob Needleman was part of it. Susan Griffin. Houston Smith. Michael Murphy. Some wonderful people. Quite a range of people were there. And I remember that we had, of course we hoped that we would just have this wonderful group. We had a two-year program, that we'd have this wonderful group where people would be really friendly with each other and cooperative and really work to, really advance the aims of the program and so forth. And, of course, we had differences. And I was not the only one who observed that often when there were differences, people seemed to go into very conventional kinds of reactions, like, I'm right, you're wrong. Versions of that. And I remember that there was something that was very important for me that occurred. One of the members of the group was a man named Robert McDermott. Some of you may know, he later became president of CIIS in San Francisco. At the time, I think he was in New York at a university there. And he made the suggestion, which I loved, which he said, because we were noticing people not being so skillful with differences, right? Here they are, so we're supposed to embody wisdom, right? So, and he made the suggestion, when you notice a difference in views, take it as a starting point for inquiry. Might there be something I can learn from this person? What are my reactions? What's going on with me when I start having reactions to this person? Is there something that I can learn about myself? You know, is there something in my past that makes me not open to this particular view? So it was wonderful. It was really saying, let me take a difference as a starting point for inquiry rather than a starting point for war. And that stayed with me. That was very powerful. And that's really, we could say, it's a version of saying, taking differences and even difficulties as an opportunity for learning. Right? So it's not easy. But that's what I want to suggest, particularly with our focus on attitude, that can we have the intention, at least, when there are difficulties or differences, to take it as a possible learning experience. So that's the first thing I wanted to say about attitude. Then about how do we work with mindfulness and wisdom? And then I'll get to working with heart practices. So, you know, in a way, I think when I was starting by saying was really suggesting that all the tools, all the practices that we may have learned are very relevant here. And, you know, I also didn't mention that it's very important to work with the ethical precepts with difficulties, to really follow those. Now, one of the ways that we can take difficult interactions or difficult situations as possible learning experiences is to start having more interest, more and more interest in our own patterns of reactivity. Again, the conditioned reaction would be to say, I'm reactive, this is lousy, let's get out of here, right? Can we start to have an interest? And I think many of us do, because it's really the basis for our practice is actually to cultivate interest in ways that we get stuck or lost or lose it or become reactive. And I think that interest in our own reactivity, when it's there, accelerates our practice. And you could see that it takes a certain amount of confidence to be able to be interested in when we lose it, to be interested in reactivity. It's not this, like all of what I'm talking about tonight, is not a beginning practice. It's an intermediate or advanced practice. It really presumes that we have some confidence, that we have some development of tools like mindfulness, wisdom, heart practices. But once we have those basics, we can start to get interested so that we actually say, oh, I'm getting reactive with this person. Oh, let me look into it. Let me inquire, you know. And we don't necessarily take the most difficult ones first. This is, again, a principle of working with difficulties or difficult interactions, is that we train with the lower or medium range of difficulties. And we work up to the most difficult. That's true with anything, really, because generally the most difficult will just get us lost for the most part. If that's not the case, then we can go there. So we have that attitude of learning. We have the attitude to really open to the situation. And then we study our practice. And this can really happen over a certain kind of sequence that, you know, at first we might only remember, like, it's the evening, and I remember, oh, I really lost it this afternoon, right? And then we can actually go back and reflect. What happened? What happened with that interaction? And we start to study it. And some of it can really happen beneficially after the fact, right? But then gradually, we start to be able to track when we become reactive, when I might, for example, be judgmental at a meeting or judgmental with a particular coworker. And I might be able to track that, start noticing it, and if we can, as much as possible, start studying it both in the moment and later in reflection. And so some of you know a story that I like to tell of a time when I was learning a lot on this, when I would go in every 2 weeks and work with a difficult boss. And I would, at first, I just started noticing that I'd get really judgmental. And if you asked me, I wouldn't actually have known more than that. But the situation kept on repeating. And I was working with a mentor, and she suggested, let's really study these interactions, right? And so I would go into the situation, and of course I'd be wanting to do what came with my role, but I also wanted to study it. And this actually becomes very important. Go into difficult situations or situations that you imagine are difficult as a detective. Go into the situations saying, I'm going to be mindful in the situation and see what comes up. And for me, it was quite important, and it took some time because I would just get very reactive, become judgmental, and as I sometimes like to say, I would typically, it took me a while to actually see what was happening. What actually was happening is I would make a point, the person would change the subject, I would get really reactive, I would withdraw emotionally to a place of distanced moral superiority, which I found very comforting. You may have a similar strategy at times. But at first I really didn't know that was happening. It took some time with a difficult interaction to actually get a sense of what the pattern was. So this kind of took place over months. And many of our most difficult relationships are happily or unhappily chronic, right? A difficult coworker, a difficult family member, right? And we have multiple opportunities, a difficult public figure, right? And so we can really have this way that we keep on investigating. And if we don't have that, we may notice that we have similar patterns with one person that we have with another person. And so I would go into that. And over time, I gradually became able really to study and notice, okay, because it took a while to notice that I was becoming reactive because I thought he wasn't listening to me, right? That took some time. So we really study the patterns of reactivity. We try to explore it in more and more depth. We may use all sorts of tools that help us. This is more, again, from the mindfulness and wisdom side. We may sometimes reflect, if we're finding a lot of animosity, we may want to reflect on the causes and conditions that are there for the other person. We don't always know them fully, but that can be very, very helpful. Do you know that line from, let's see where I have it, from Longfellow? I think I have it here. It's actually connected also with forgiveness. If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each person's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility, right? That we can actually contemplate what is leading the other person to act in the way that we find difficult. Right? Read that again. If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each person's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. And I think many of us have had these important experiences. I know I've had many of them, many, 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 where there was some difficult interaction and there was a close enough relationship where we could each report what we experienced without blaming or judging the other. and just report it and say, when this happened, this is what I was experiencing. You know, and really keep to a kind of radical reflexivity, just talking about one's own experience. And I have found that uniformly when I do that with a friend or a colleague, their compassion arises. And we have a sense, oh, this is what was happening. Oh, I can really see why, because of this person's past, that person interpreted what I did in this way. Right? And having that sense of causes and conditions, that brings in what we might call the wisdom dimension. We can contemplate that even when we don't know all the facts. And of course, if there's a way of getting to that, those facts, that's very helpful. And so we use mindfulness to investigate the patterns, to see what's there, to ultimately to see how, if we can, how there is a kind of pain in the situation. A lot of times all of our reasons, our interpretations, cover over the fact that there's actually pain with a difficult interaction. You know, that we may feel, like in my example, it didn't feel good to think this person is not listening to me. My own experience was primarily at the level of judgment. I didn't actually feel the pain. As I looked more into it, I could actually start to feel, and I started to feel it in the moment. Oh, that doesn't feel good, right? To actually, and that, when we start bringing it into direct experience, we can start to see where all the thinking, where all the judgments come from. And it actually can be a basis for an interaction that says, oh, that felt really painful. You know, I have a friend who I like to talk about who, when she has something difficult happen to her, she says, ouch. You know, and I think that's extremely skillful to say, ouch. You know, it sounds cute, right? You know, ouch. Now I know there, you know, I have friends who are now in groups where people do that in the groups. People say something that feels, you know, whatever, judgmental, and someone just will say very loudly, ouch. You know, and everyone looks at that person, oops. You know, and it actually, I've heard that in some groups, it actually can really shift the energy. It's like someone saying, that was painful. Right? It's not saying, don't do that again. It's not being reactive. It's actually going to the pain. Very, very crucial. So the mindfulness and the wisdom keep on going more deeply. We see what's there. We see our patterns. We see our, can reflect on our own history, our own conditioning, what leads me to react with this person in this way. We can reflect on the other person. That all tends to lead more to a sense of compassion, more to a sense of understanding. And then we can actually use, and this is the last area I'll talk about, we can use the heart practices. And last time, in particular, I talked about forgiveness. And we can remember that there are these family of heart practices which are beautiful for working with difficult situations. You know, and I'm going to talk a little bit about metta, or loving kindness, a little bit about compassion, and then a little bit more about forgiveness, but briefly about all of them. And then we'll have some time for discussion. Metta is this quality, as we know, of learning to lead with the heart. And in fact, all of the heart practices give us ways that we want to be increasingly with the intention to come out every situation with kindness and warmth, no matter what happens. And so we cultivate that first in protected environments. That's what meditation is. Meditation training, to say the obvious, is about creating protected environments where we train. And the aim isn't to stay in the protected environments, right? It's to live our lives, right? And we bring out those practices into our daily lives and try to apply mindfulness, loving kindness, compassion, and so forth in our daily lives. And that's not always easy. That's why we have to talk about it. And I think that we often give more attention to the private experience of meditation. In my mind, not enough attention to really how we live all this, particularly with difficulties. That's my own view that we, and I think we're still evolving on that. And so we learn in meditation to lead more with the heart. That's what all the heart practices are. That's what metta practice is. It's inclining towards kindness and doing it where it flows most easily initially, and then learning to bring it into more difficult circumstances. But it's really, metta practice is continually being with ourselves, with others in our meditation, where we learn how to just bring the heart forward. And it's a wonderful training, a beautiful training. And then we gradually bring that into the flow of our daily life. And we know from the great text on metta, the Metta Sutta, that ultimately we bring this so that it's a default way that we meet everything, that we meet everyone, or at least we have that intention to meet every being with kindness, spreading upwards to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, this is from the Metta Sutta, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection of inclining towards kindness. This is said to be the sublime abiding, words from almost 2,600 years ago. This inclination of towards the kind heart as a practice, you know, and we do that, and we don't always get the kind heart. We can say, okay, may you be well, or may I be well. And we say that to ourselves silently, and then we get stuff. Stuff comes up, right? We say, we have an inner argument with ourselves. I don't deserve loving kindness. I've messed up, you know, or whatever it is. Or this person doesn't deserve it. Or may you be loving and kind. May you get it together so you're not such a pain. And so our loving kindness practice. This is not a classical phrase, but it's something that we find particularly when we start bringing metta and loving kindness practice into those with whom we have difficulty. We find that it becomes, shall we say, self-interested. Self-interested, and we want people to get it together so they're not so difficult. And so there's that aspect of purification. And we may also do compassion practice. And actually, personally, I have found that for working with a heart practice with people with whom I have difficulty, compassion and forgiveness work for me better than metta or loving kindness. Now, it's great to do loving kindness generally or do it where it flows, but in terms of actually doing a practice with bringing in people with whom I've had difficulty, I find compassion and forgiveness are more effective, I think, because they go right into the pain. They go right into what's difficult. I do compassion practice, and the line that I might use is, may I or may you be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. And when I bring that into someone with whom I've had difficulty, I tend to go into where that person has pain or where we have pain. And I just go there, and I feel the pain, and something softens a little bit, or it can. That's a lot. That's how forgiveness practice works as well. We use these phrases, and something softens, so we can really touch the pain, and we have more empathy. We have more empathy for that person's suffering or that person's difficulty, because we know that when we have difficulties with someone, generally, we tend to take positions. The open heart closes, empathy goes out the window, and we hold positions. I'm right, you're wrong is the usual one. It might be, you're right, I'm wrong. You know, some of us go there. But typically, it's I'm right, you're wrong, I hold a position, and we polarize, and neither of us has empathy, and we may do mean things to each other. We may cause a lot of suffering. And so anything which takes us back to that empathy is going to be helpful. The compassion practice can do that, or just sitting with the situation can open up the compassion. And then lastly, just to say a few more words about forgiveness. You know, I mentioned in the opening to the practice that forgiveness is this way of saying, I have a difficult situation in relation to another, or could be in relation to myself, and I want to incline to be with that situation with a kind heart. Forgiveness practice signifies that intention. Now, I may not get there. I may do forgiveness practice and find I have a tremendous amount of anger. My heart's closed down. But forgiveness practice is the inclination towards that kind heart. And it's the inclination towards freedom. Again, the point of forgiveness practice, as we do it as an inner practice particularly, is that when I am reactive towards something that's happened in relation to another, in relation to myself, I am caught or I am stuck. When I am reactive, meaning judgmental, aversive, fearful, caught in anger, and so forth, I will do things that lead to suffering for myself or others, and that I can acknowledge that I am both reactive and that there's something very important about the situation that should not be dismissed. In other words, again, something may have happened that was wrong, that was not okay, that should not be repeated. I can set boundaries. I can say, that was not okay. And I can still work for forgiveness practice. I can still do the forgiveness practice. I can still try to forgive. And last time, I gave a lot of very powerful examples. Some of them were from South Africa. Do you remember those examples? It was very amazing that in that situation, due to the skill of people like Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu, who was the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they were able to approach a situation of intense violence and have forgiveness as a possibility. While not at all saying that what happened was okay. In fact, they were saying that it was not okay. And they wanted people to acknowledge that. From Nelson Mandela. If there are dreams about a beautiful South Africa, there are also roads that lead to that goal. Two of these roads could be named goodness and forgiveness. This is the president of a country, right? This is a great leader. This is from Desmond Tutu talking about Nelson Mandela. Before Nelson Mandela was arrested in 1962, he was an angry, relatively young man. He founded the African National Congress's military wing. When he was released, this was 27 years ago, he surprised everyone because he was talking about reconciliation and forgiveness and not about revenge. Right? So quite remarkable. So, and I gave a lot of stories. And that forgiveness can really open up to freedom. The philosopher Hannah Arendt says, forgiveness is the key to action and the key to freedom. Because as long as we are held by reactivity, we're actually not free. And so I mentioned that there are all sorts of ways to practice forgiveness. Maybe some of you did in daily life. I use forgiveness practice as a daily cleanser. And I think of it that way somewhat. I think of, if I say something unskillful, if I act unskillfully, to the extent that I remember, I do an internal forgiveness practice, sometimes external, sometimes talking to the person. And it's a way, I think of it as cleaning up a mess, small, medium, or large. Cleaning up a mess on the spot or relatively close to the time it happened. So I like to, if I do something unskillful in driving, or if someone does something unskillful in driving in relation to me, I like to work with forgiveness practice. Right? And work in these small ways. People say things, I think last time I mentioned the example of a telemarketer calls, I'm in the middle of something, I say something a little bit curt to the telemarketer, I realize that, telemarketer, we've hung up, do forgiveness practice in relationship to the telemarketer. So there are all these small ways that we can work with it, as well as larger ways that we can work with forgiveness. So powerful practice. I think I'll end just with a few end quotes and then see if we have some questions or something from our own experience of working with forgiveness since the last time I was here. So ending with two readings. The first really suggests how when we work with difficulties that we have in our interactions with others, rather and go towards wisdom, compassion, the open heart, rather than reactivity, we are really offering something to the world. It's actually a gift that we're giving to the world. We are giving the gift of understanding and peace in that moment. I think it's quite profound. This is from John Tarrant, a Zen teacher, who uses the metaphor of darkness or difficulty as being like darkness. And there are other ways we can think of darkness more positively, but he uses it in the sense of difficulty. He says, to pay the dark, and we can think of it as difficulties, to pay the dark is to carry the stone of our own suffering. The courage with which we bear our own darkness frees others from having to carry it for us. So it's an offering to the world, and it's taking responsibility. And then Dorothy Day to close. The greatest challenge of our time is how to bring about a revolution of the heart. You will know your vocation by the joy it brings you. You will know. You will know when it's right. Don't worry about being effective. Just concentrate on being faithful to the truth. So thank you for your kind attention. And we have some time for any discussion, questions, reports from your own experience, perhaps with forgiveness. Vita, please. And I'll repeat the questions.
Okay, so this is really very personal and very right now. So I have a forgiveness practice that I do every day. I've been doing this for a couple of years. I'm even able to have great compassion and understanding for ex-husbands.
I mean,
this is quite,
advanced practice.
And it's true. And it's true. I really, and less judgmental and less difficult with myself, thanks to your practice. I have a situation right now where I am so angry with what somebody has done.
Yeah.
As a difficult person who I'm usually much better. I'm usually okay.
Yeah.
That I'm not even ready to forgive her.
Yeah.
I told my daughter about it, and I said, and do not try to give me advice on how to make this better, because I'm not ready yet to give up this, and of course it's in my heart. I feel it.
Yeah, so really a question and reflection about a situation in which she finds herself very angry towards someone who she has had ongoing relationship with, very, very angry, and doesn't feel ready for forgiveness. And so, yeah, this was probably something I talked about more last time, but forgiveness can't be forced. And sometimes, and we may not be ready for forgiveness, and that is totally okay. Now, it's helpful to hold from the wisdom perspective that you might like to get there in the future, so that you have that. But meanwhile, you could check in and see how it is with forgiveness, but if you did that and you just feel the anger is like a wall, yeah, that's fine. Because forgiveness practice isn't about deciding when forgiveness should occur and demanding that it occur. It's like all of the heart practices. We hold that inclining in that way, and sometimes we have to be with the anger.
I can't even do loving kindness for this person.
Yeah, yeah. So it would seem appropriate to, and can you be present with the anger?
Oh, I even feel the anger.
Yeah, so you can work. So I would say, your practice now sounds like it's skillful practice with anger. Yeah, you have to explain the laughter, but no, it sounds like, I mean, it's there. I mean, I imagine if you sit, it's there some, right?
Oh, it's there.
Yeah, it's there. So your practice at the moment sounds like it's primarily being skillful with the anger, which is tremendous, tremendously important, and is part and parcel in the big picture of what might lead in the long run to working through it and forgiveness. But your point brings up very helpfully that forgiveness and even any kind of open heart, any of the heart states, we don't demand it. We incline and we see where it's there, and sometimes it's not the right time, or sometimes we have to be with anger for a long time.
I mean, I don't, but I'm almost ready, like, to do the loving kindness practice and say, except for. I mean, I don't, but it's that kind of.
Yeah, and the other thing, you know, if you want to, would be to, if you're inclined this way, would be to just continue with the heart practices, but don't bring it near this person. You know, so you still keep the heart practices developing, or the forgiveness practice developing, but just where it flows okay.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thanks. Please, yeah.
At one point you said, reflect on the causes and conditions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where I get, and I understand intellectually what you're leading up to. However, the situation that I have been in with a very difficult person,
yeah.
I tend to get into the psychology for dummies.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to say, well, you know, if this person were a little bit more aware of what's going on, maybe this person could act differently.
Yeah.
Instead of just, you know, looking at that as, or the other thing, oh, this poor person.
Yeah.
Why don't they see what's happening?
Yeah.
So, you know, I get really bogged down in that kind of reaction rather than trying to be a little bit more compassionate. That's kind of
So the comment is about in thinking about this particular person, there seems to be primarily judgment, blaming, being reactive in different ways towards this person. And what does reflection mean there? Again, we can't force it, but sometimes there can be I think probably two things occurred to me. One of them is somehow to tune in to what's painful with the situation can tend to soften things. You know, so just it would be could be compassion just for yourself, or you know, and that might be easier than compassion for the other. But some of the heart practices, and maybe starting with yourself, because you can acknowledge your own suffering. The kinds of reflections that can sometimes be skillful are ones that sometimes can cut through the quality of being judgmental. You know, and it takes some skill. It might be to ask a question like, to what extent am I exaggerating the negative qualities of this person? You know, is there something I could learn from this person? A little bit like my example with the philosophy group, right? Is there something I might learn from this person? Is it possible that I'm not entirely right? That sometimes can start to shift things. Right. Is it possible that I'm not entirely right? Is there something that I don't understand? Right. So you can see how certain questions open up a little bit of space. Those are reflection questions. Do any of those resonate with you?
Yeah, the one about something here that I don't understand and I'm not seeing. What happened, in this, I'm thinking of a real situation that existed, and this particular individual was very, very difficult to be around. When I was around that individual, I could feel a lot
Yeah.
I had to have that distance because this individual kept doing this all the time, mm-hmm. and everything came up, and so it got to be wearing.
Yeah. Generally, what we want to do is to find ways that create a little more space in the mind and softening of the heart. We can use reflection sometimes in that way, or it just could be, to what extent is this person driven by pain? To what extent am I finding pain? To what extent is this person trying to meet a need? And it can soften things, yeah. Maybe just one more, I think, then we want to go to the metta. Yeah.
I tend to have an easier time with forgiveness, the compassion piece. The piece that I have a harder time with is setting the boundaries.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I will sort of default to, well, there's something going wrong with them or whatever. And sometimes I get confused, too, with, like, for instance, I love that phrase, ouch, or that, you know, yeah. saying ouch. I forget it all the time, but I like that the idea of it. Is there something similar that I could say to myself or that I could use as a trigger to be able to sort of set a boundary or to sort of, because I fall into just trying to accommodate the other person.
Yeah, how to set a boundary in an interpersonal relationship when there's difficulty. Now, again, this is getting into the territory that I didn't explore tonight, and there's a lot, you know, that we could say about relationships.
Right.
And setting boundaries and so forth. So maybe another time, when I come another time, we can go into that in more detail. I think that some of it is learning how to use speech skillfully in a difficult circumstance in which you stand up for yourself. So part of it is an internal process of knowing actually what you need in that moment, or getting a sense of what is happening for yourself, and not going too quickly to the let me be accommodating, right? So some of it's based on a mindfulness in the moment. What am I feeling? And so it can be useful sometimes to take a time out, if that's suitable. You're having a difficult interaction at work. You want to set a boundary. You don't know how to. You're a little confused. Go to the bathroom. Go to the bathroom. You know, take a time out. And then maybe you can come back and really know more clearly what you're feeling. Because all of this is dependent on being mindful of what's going on inside. And a lot of times we override that, right? That's what you're saying sometimes happens. We override our own mindfulness because we think we need to act in a certain way. So being mindful of what we're actually experiencing has to be a starting point for then being able to say, it took me a while to learn with my boss to say something like, what I just said, it's an important point for me, and I'd like for us to come back to it, right? Pretty simple, non-reactive. It took a while to learn how to do that, right? And I had to be able to be in, for me, I had to actually be in touch with the pain of not, I would say, him not listening to me. And I had to be able to be in touch with my need and then be able to learn how to bring it into speech. So there are a few components there. So it's actually a lot in what you asked. But those would be the components. Inner mindfulness, knowing what the actual need is in the moment, some ways of skillfully setting boundaries or speaking in certain ways. That'd be the short response. There's a lot more we could say. Great. Okay, time for our closing with the metta cards.
For a friend whose sister is suffering from alcoholism, for a sister and her family, Paula, Jim, James, and Elizabeth, because they're good people. For Ruth and her family, who lost 11-year-old Lila on Monday. Mm. For these people with health problems, Paul, Cheryl M., and Bruce S. For Norma Ramos after a bad auto accident, and for Mitzi, who had a stroke and can't communicate. For a son and daughter as they deal with life struggles. For Barbara, who is in hospice, and her husband Lou and their family. And for Otto with Alzheimer's and depression. Mm.
Thank you very much. Just one or two words, and then we'll have a closing metta. My suggestion is that if some of this was helpful, or seems like it could be helpful, to bring it into practice in the next period of time. You know, it'd be great if I would come back next week and we would compare notes. I think I don't come back till April. So... but my suggestion would be to take some of these practices. Again, the core practices which I focused on were first the attitude. Having an attitude in which we take difficulties as potential learning experiences, in which we intend to bring mindfulness, wisdom, and the kind heart to a situation, even when it's difficult. We have at least that intent, at least long term. We don't force it, as in the discussion of when forgiveness doesn't flow immediately. We don't force it, but we have that long term intention. So first, the attitude, not so easy to bring into practice in difficult circumstances, of wanting to learn from situations. Secondly, we bring mindfulness and wisdom in. So for some of us, we may want to take what was helpful by saying, I'm going to really study my pattern of reactivity for the next period of time, you know, and really try to look at it, be mindful, watch it, study how it manifests in different circumstances and so forth, the second area. And then thirdly, the work with the heart practices, metta, compassion, forgiveness. We may want to work with, for example, forgiveness practice for every day, do it for 10 or 15 minutes for a week or for a month. You know, and there's beautiful material on forgiveness. There's wonderful books. You know, some of you may know there's a man named Fred Luskin who set up a Center for Forgiveness at Stanford. Has done some wonderful work. He has a book called Forgive for Good. And there, Desmond Tutu wrote a book, No Future Without Forgiveness, which has amazing stories from South Africa. Really quite inspiring. It's quite amazing work on forgiveness. So you may want to take one of that. I think if we can have, some of us may just want to say, I want to really have a heart practice I do every day for 10 or 15 minutes. That will go a long way. That will start to go into the other parts of one's life. So I'll end with that as a way of suggesting a way to go. And let me just invite you, we'll do two things to finish. One, I'll invite you just to ask yourself, with what intention do I leave our time together? It's just for yourself. Is there an intention coming out of our session tonight? And then may we feel our area of our hearts. And feel that intention to be kind, if you can access that. Quality of warmth in the heart. Tenderness. Even vulnerability. May we offer that kind heart to ourselves And may we offer it out into this hall for others who are here tonight. And then may we have the intention to offer that kind heart as best we can in every encounter in this life. To people we meet, and then ultimately to offer that to the world, ultimately to all beings, that offering of the kind heart, our own kind heart.